You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Kind of fitting. Title of this song is called Bruises.
Haven't seen you since high school. Good to see you're still beautiful. Gravity hasn't started to form quite yet. I bet you're rich as hell.
One that's five and one that's three. In 2 years since he left me.
Let me read to you an email. I said Ohio man was getting into me. All right. So he took the time to write this. So let me read it. Before you hear Don Mapes, it's about 44 minutes, so you get a little extra All Marine Radio time today. You were on a roll until you blamed the internet. Wrong. Now, in the first hour, if you missed it, I was talking about watching cowardly politicians coupled with a media that doesn't tell the truth anymore, and how amazing our democracy is, that, you know, the infrastructure of which it was written in the late 18th century to withstand this toxic concoction of idiots and idiocy. Okay, so that's what he's referring to here. So you'll get a chance to listen to it here in a little bit. I'll post it on the internet in the next hour. The internet is just a form of communication, just like a newspaper, TV, or TV news. Clicks are synonymous with circulation. The problem is that some people that want to believe the bullshit, you're getting perilously close to talking about very deep issues. There are hundreds of thousands of interactions daily between police and young aggressive males and some females. 99% of the time, these interactions go the way they should. Occasionally, a cop makes a mistake, and the result is a bad shoot. Philando Castile in Minnesota comes to mind. Oklahoma, too. I forgot the name of the guy in Minnesota. His name was Philando Castile. He's the guy, again, we've all seen the video, or I think most people have. He's the cop's scared, you can tell in his voice. And he's saying, hey, I've got a gun. I've got a concealed carry permit. And he gets shot and killed. Even rarer are the examples when a cop does something consciously heinous. The North Charleston, South Carolina shooting, and more recently the Chicago shooting are examples. Exactly. I personally believe another occurred in St. Louis, not Mike Brown, that you spoke about one day when the cop was acquitted, even though he was fired soon after the shooting. Cheap cameras or phones and body cams have changed the world we live in. I think it's a good thing as long as we do due diligence to seek the truth. The jury that acquitted the four cops that were beating Rodney King really did a disservice to our society. Who the fuck wants to be a cop these days, especially with gutless politicians talking shit in front of the cameras? Yeah, you know, that was my larger point was, it's amazing that our country survives gutless politicians and a media that doesn't concern themselves with the truth. Now, my point about the internet is this. There used to be a balance in the media. At least, balance might not even be the right word. The media used to be more divided, right? And most towns had both conservative voices and liberal voices in those communities. What the internet did was it put a lot of those newspapers out of business to the point where you only have one voice. And one voice, right, is not in a community tends not to be good. And that was the point I was trying to make. For instance, San Diego used to have the San Diego Union in the morning and the Tribune in the afternoon. I think they merged and became the San Diego Union Tribune. Where I grew up in Sacramento, We had the San Diego Union in the morning, and we had the Sacramento Bee in the afternoon. I delivered the Sacramento Union. I was not a very good newspaper boy. I was good at throwing newspapers, but I sucked at collecting money, and I didn't always want to get up. And I did most of the time, so I did it for I don't know how many months. Get up in the morning, and it was hard money to make, honestly. And then at about that time, more and more adults got involved in it, delivering newspapers from cars, which is easier. You didn't have to, you know, you folded them, you threw them in the front seat, and then you drove down the street and you fired them out of the car. Much less time. They could do larger areas, and so they were taking paper routes from kids, to the point that now I don't think there are any kids that do paper routes anymore. But anyway, that was the way it was. And you had two newspapers, and they endorsed competing candidates. I mean, when you only have one newspaper, should it endorse candidates in a city where there is no counterbalance? Is that ethical? Well, the newspaper will say, well, what are we supposed to do, not endorse people? Maybe. Anyway, that would require you to live up to a higher ethical standard, which we all know is virtually impossible. So the problem is that people want to believe the bullshit. So that's where he says I went wrong. But haven't people, whether it's in news, so to use your argument against you there, Ohio man, haven't people always wanted to believe the bullshit? Right? So if your argument's consistent, the internet is just another form of communication. So there was bullshit served by newspapers before the advent of the internet. Why would it change that people want to believe the bullshit? People haven't changed. They've always wanted to believe the bullshit. My problem is that there's less diversity of opinion, and that's the problem. And now you have, you know, media controlled by fewer and fewer people, which is a problem. So, anyway. Turkey. Fuck Turkey. Let NATO trade them for the Ukraine. No to the F-35. Are we stupid? You know what? Much is made about what? The Incirlik Air Base in Turkey? Is that the name of it? Is that in Iceland? What's the air base in Turkey, where, you know, which has become Incirlik Air Base in Turkey? Outside of the city of Adana, Turkey. Yeah, that's the... So, we unass Turkey. And leave, you know, again, Turkey reminds me of Iran in that, you know, the majority of Turkish people are pro-Western leaning people and whatnot. But it is being held hostage, I would say, by Mr. Erdogan, who has empowered the fundamentalist elements. And let me tell you, wherever that gets unleashed in a country, it does not turn out good. It's not good for business. It's good for Mr. Erdogan. If you want a dictator, but Turkey and Turkey's military has always been the regulator of the Turkish democracy. So anyway, so all right. Having read those, let me get to Don Mates. Now, I run across these things now, right? And they're pretty cool. And so, as when the show gets over, I'll be working, I'll be writing, I'll be doing something, and I'll put an interview on. That's how I heard the interview with Sledge and his family and whatnot. So this is how I heard this interview. And I was actually listening to another interview, and this came on right behind it. And I heard this, and I was like, oh, let me listen to that. So Don Mates, it's a wonderful interview. And he talks about where he comes from and how he got into the Marine Corps and whatnot. So, and it, again, it's done by the American Veterans Center. Let me see if this is hyperlinked. Honor their service, honor their sacrifice. The American Veterans Center videos. those. So it doesn't say a whole lot about that. Yeah, these are... Wow, this is about the kissing sailor, George Mendoza, M-O-N-D-O-N, Mendoza, who just recently passed away. And then the statue was spray-painted, right? Right. The statue was spray-painted with the whole Me Too thing. So, anyway. All right. Without further ado, you'll enjoy this. Don Mates, United States Marine Corps, the Battle of Guam and the Battle of Iwo Jima. So, anyway, as I said, you'll enjoy this. If I can get
our guest this week on Veterans Chronicles is Don Mates, a veteran of World War II. He served in the 3rd Division of the U.S. Marine Corps and is a veteran of the Battle of Iwo Jima. Don, thank you very much for your time with us today.
Glad to be here.
Let's start, obviously, at the very beginning. Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Cleveland, Ohio, February 10, 1926. Calvin Coolidge was president.
And did your family have a history of military service of any kind?
No. But when I had two brothers that served, one in the Navy and one in the Air Force. And, of course, I served in the U.S. Marine Corps during World War II. They were younger than me, and they served after in the Korean and Vietnam.
And were you drafted or did you enlist?
I enlisted.
Why did you choose the Marine Corps?
In 1943, a recruiter came to John Hay High School in Cleveland, Ohio, and he said, you're 17 years old and you're going to turn 18. They're going to draft you. Why don't you enlist in the Marines? We'll let you graduate from high school, and you can pick what job you wanted in the Marine Corps. And I said that I'd consider it, and my parents had a sign, and they signed. And he told me that, and he asked me before I signed what I would like to do in the Marines. And I asked him, I'd like to first get the dress blue uniform. And he told me that they only issued the dress blue uniform to seagoing Marines, band members, Marine Corps band, the Drum and Bugle Corps, and to embassy guards. And I told him that I got seasick and that I didn't play an instrument. Could I be an embassy guard? And he says, well, he said, you're 6'2", you're in shape. He said, I'll put that down as your first choice. And he said to me, where would you like to serve? And I said, I knew that Portugal was neutral. And I knew they had two colonies. One was Goa in India, and one was Macau in China. And Macau interested me because of the gambling and the nightlife that went with it. And he says, well, then I'll put down Macau as your first choice, and Portugal is second choice. Well, I'm going to tell you, to this day, I'm looking for that recruiter. That's how I joined the Marines. I joined it for the uniform, which I never did get till the end of the war.
Did you ever get to Macau?
Never got. I haven't been there yet.
So
that's how I ended up in the Marines.
Well, where did you do your training?
Because I did my boot camp training in Paris Island, and from Paris Island, because it helped that I was an Eagle Scout, and they assigned me to a very high sounding job, and it was a combat intelligence school, and basically combat intelligence school is nothing but a scout and observer. And that lasted 8 weeks. And they taught you how to operate a 560 radio They taught you demolitions. They taught you map reading. And they taught you a little Japanese, which was useless. The nighttime patrolling, which actually, when it was in combat, we did do that. Rubber boat reconnaissance, which we never did. The frogmen in the Navy did that. And that's where I was trained. We also were taught how to operate a 50 caliber and 25 caliber machine gun, a BAR, Browning automatic rifle, and of course the M1 rifle, which every Marine had, even the cooks and bakers.
Was there any particular part of that that you found the most interesting or hoped you would be doing when you were deployed?
Well, I was really brainwashed during World War II by the movies, by the newspapers, radio, magazines, posters, and I really believed that the Japanese were super evil, and that we were super good, and that I was just, I don't want to say snowed, but I was just psychologically affected, never dreaming of what I was getting into. It was the propaganda that that got to me, and I was just looking forward to being a Marine and going into combat, never dreaming that anything could happen.
So, after training, how much of a time span was there between that and being deployed?
Oh, after training, it was I immediately went overseas, but even going overseas, I left Norfolk on the ship called the Florence Nightingale, and our we were going through the Panama Canal, but our first stop was in Cuba, where we got liberty. Cuba was quite a place for liberty in the 1940s, and then we stopped in Panama, which was got liberty in Panama, and then I went to a replacement depot in Hawaii, and I thought, my God, this is just a marvelous exactly what I expected, and it wasn't a celebrity cruise, but it was the Navy treated you royally. You could sleep on deck, and you could eat anytime you wanted or have coffee anytime you wanted. All you had to do was stand in line. So it was just up until that point, it was marvelous. And it got even better when they sent me to Guam, which was being liberated by the 3rd Marine Division. They sent me by with three other replacements. And we went by aircraft carrier, and that's like a cruise. I mean, even at an ice cream bar there, everything but a nightclub on the ship. And that was an 8-day short-term cruise, and then the proverbial hit the fan when I landed at Guam. Then I knew that it wasn't like the movies.
And where are we on the calendar at this point?
We're into, they invaded in July. And July 24th is the decoration, they celebrate July 24th as the day that we invaded and the Japanese lost control. And their July 24th is our July 4th. And I hit about July 28th, and I was immediately sent to the reconnaissance company that I had trained for. And we were sent not into the lines. We were sent to the northern end of the island. And the big fighting was in the southern end of the island. We were sent to Ratidian Point. And that's where we did our fighting, and that's where we went into our combat. That's where we set up booby traps and ambushes, and as they were being driven north, we were up there waiting for them. As they came up from the south, the Japanese, and it wasn't a pretty picture.
What type of action were you witnessing?
It was mostly patrolling, and at that point they hadn't been that far north, the Japanese, but you still had to be aware of booby traps, and you had to be aware of mines, and as the Japanese fled north, there was no taking prisoners on either side. It was kill or be killed. And we got into some firefights. We got into a lot of grenade throwing. We didn't have any heavy artillery, but we had a 25 millimeter and 50 millimeter machine guns. The only good point about Retidian Point was the rations were K rations and C rations were nothing to write home about, but what we did was we would throw grenades into the ocean and we'd stun the fish, and then we'd take the newest replacement, have them strip, go out and get the fish, and we'd eat either fresh fish raw, and we ate anything that came up except if it had spikes on it, that was poisonous. Or we'd have a fish fry, and that was the only pleasurable part about fighting up on Retidian Point, was we could break loose a little bit.
Just about a minute left before we take our first break. How difficult was it to adjust to combat? You had obviously gone through a lot of training, but when you hit the real thing,
well, you realize it's not like the movies. And it's the old story where there were 100 of us there, and if they asked for 98 volunteers, and that they asked for 100 volunteers, and they told that only two of you were coming back, and there were 98 casualties, well, you looked around to see who the other lucky fellow was. You never dreamed. You never dreamt that anything would happen to you. So when something happened to one of your buddies, it comes as a shock, and it's you become anxious, you become stressed, and it's there's a smell, there's a couple smells that you don't get over, and that's the smell of fresh blood coming out of somebody. If somebody's artery is cut and the blood gushes out, there's nothing you can do about it. That odor of sweet blood stays with you. And the other odor is that of a decaying body. We never buried the Japanese, and their bodies just decayed. Even to this day, if I drive by a cemetery and if they're using recycled water, I think I can smell the dead bodies. Those are two smells you never get over with.
Don, let's pause right there. When we come back, we'll hear more of your story about your service in World War II in the Pacific, and specifically Iwo Jima. We're talking with Don Mates, veteran of the 3rd Infantry Division of the U.S. Marine Corps, veteran of Iwo Jima. This is Veterans Chronicles. Our guest on Veterans Chronicles this week is Don Mates. He's a veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps in World War II, veteran of Guam, as we heard in the last segment, as well as Iwo Jima, which we'll get to shortly. Don, you were just talking about your service on Guam and some of the memories and even the sense that will stay with you for the rest of your life. At this point, how much bonding had you done with your group, and had you met Jimmy Trimble, who we'll talk about a lot more as time goes on?
Well, Jimmy Trimble and I met in the States. And the bonding that goes on in the Marine Corps stays with you till the till the day you die. I volunteer at a VA hospital in Florida, in West Palm Beach. And if I see a Marine standing in line waiting, I'll pull him out of line and get him to his appointment immediately. I'm the commander of the Military Order of the Purple Heart, and I make a special effort. Not that I don't help as many people as I can, but I make a special effort with the Marines. And it's true, there's no such thing as an ex-Marine. Once a Marine, always a Marine. And Jimmy and I became close, very close, because one, we were tent mates after Guam was secure, and two, he was a Major League Baseball pitcher. He had signed with the Washington Senators, and in 1943, Clark Griffith gave him a $5,000 signing bonus and sent him to Duke and paid for his college. He didn't send him to a farm team. He wanted him to, he would play for the Duke baseball team. Well, Jimmy kept the $5,000, went to Duke for about a week, and then enlisted in the Marines. Jimmy and I went through combat intelligence school together. We went overseas together. And we were the best of buddies. And we were tent mates. And because he was an outstanding pitcher, and our commanding general, Erskine Graves, was a baseball nut. And we had six Marine divisions in the Pacific. And among the six divisions, there was a round-robin World Series. And General Graves wanted to win that World Series. And lo and behold, General Graves when Jimmy pitched the winning game, and we won the Marine Corps World Series, he became a favorite of the general, and the general said to him, I want you to be my bodyguard. And he says, pick whoever you want. And of course, Jimmy picked me. So I just tagged along and got some of Jimmy's glory rubbed off on me. And we became bodyguards for General Erskine, which just meant when he was in his tent sleeping, we were outside. When he was in the seat, when he was awake, we were awake. When he was asleep, we took turns sleeping. So that's how I ended up with Trimble, and being my fast buddy and also my combat buddy. You team up in a foxhole. Yeah, and Trimble was in the foxhole with me.
We're right about at the time that we record this, the 70th anniversary of the start of the Battle of Iwo Jima. Where were you and what did you do between Guam and February of 1945 when you went to Iwo Jima?
Well, the first thing we did was we trained. But because of the job that I had, I didn't have to do any practice landings. The most I had to do was an occasional patrol to look for stray Japanese. The third reconnaissance company consisted of four platoons. And one platoon, the fourth platoon, was spun off, even though it was part of the reconnaissance company, and was assigned to General Graves. General Graves didn't want information coming up through the chain of command. When he wanted to know something, whether it was on the island of Guam or about a patrol, he wanted a first-hand report from the participants. So our platoon was assigned to him specifically. We were at his beck and call. What the Swiss Guard is to the Pope, we were General Graves. So we didn't participate in all the rugged training that the other troops did. We were in shape, but we had it pretty easy. because of our position.
By the time the Battle of Iwo Jima started, obviously the Allies were doing very, very well in the Pacific. Did you have a pretty good sense of that, where you were, that the tide of the war in the Pacific was clearly in your favor?
Yeah, well, of course, we were taking island after island, and we were basically inflicting heavy casualties on the Japanese. And the to be truthful, I personally didn't have the big picture. I had no idea that MacArthur was going to swing to the east and come up through the Philippines, and that was where he was headed, and then we were to go to the west and do island hopping. Napoleon once said that the soldier in his army, his view of the big picture was the pack on the back of the soldier in front of him, and that's sort of covered my view of World War II. I didn't really have a big picture. All I knew was what my job was and what I knew was going on where I was at. I had no idea of the stepping stones and that Okinawa would be next and that they were planning to invade Japan and that Peleliu and Tarawa were taken because of the airfields, and none of that came through to me. I found out about Iwo Jima and Guam after I got out, and I read all about it. I found out what I was involved in. But when you're a private pushing to become a PFC, making $30 a month, you're just concerned where your next meal's coming from, what it's going to be, and who's the unfortunate fellow that's going to get shot instead of you.
Don, we'll pause right there. When we come back, our final segment, and we'll learn all about your role in the Battle of Iwo Jima right after this on Veterans Chronicles. I'm Greg Corumbus. This is Veterans Chronicles. We're honored to be joined today in studio by Don Mates, a veteran of World War II, veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps. Sir, just before the break, we were leading right up to the beginning of the Battle of Iwo Jima, which began on February 19th. You went ashore on the 24th. What was the state of the battle at that point, and describe coming ashore?
Well, first, we were sent ashore to set up sleeping quarters and a CP for General Erskine. And when we landed on the beach, it was just absolute chaos. I thought I had seen quite a bit in Guam, but this came as a shock. They hadn't yet started to bury any of the bodies. They were bloated. There were maggots. There were parts of bodies. There were Marines that had no head, missing legs. There was broken equipment. There was wounded lined up on the beach like railway ties. It was just utter chaos, and it seemed like the one with the loudest voice was the one that was in command. We set up Erskine, and again his bodyguard. We were Trimble and I, and the Japanese had spigot mortars. And a spigot mortar is bigger than a 55-gallon oil drum. It's just loaded with explosives. It's rocket-propelled. And it tumbles. After the rocket burns out, it reminds you of reminded me of the Road Runner in cartoons. You may see it occasionally now on TV, the kids may, where the Road Runner looks up and a piano is going to fall on him and crushes him, or a truck runs him over, and he's flattened out. Well, that's how you felt when you saw this tumbling 55-gallon oil drum coming towards you. It blew a tremendous hole in the ground, and there wasn't much shrapnel, but the concussion was horrible. And if you were close enough, you'd bleed from the ears, you'd bleed from the nose, your brain really got rattled. And one landed near Erskine, and he, up until that point, the recon company had not been, you could get shot anywhere on Iwo. It was 2x4. They put 30,000 of us ashore, and there were 21,000 of them. So you just throw a grenade anywhere and you hit something. In fact, when we got ashore, I threw a phosphorus grenade into a spider hole or spider trap, and Trimble yelled to me. He says, "Look behind you." And the smoke from the phosphorus grenade came out behind me, and they had 17 miles of tunnels throughout, and they could scurry everywhere. They figured the battle would last 3 days, and of course it lasted from February 19th till March 27th. Anyway, Erskine wanted to find out where these spigot mortars were coming from. They were coming night and day. And he said that you could see them better at night. So he asked for our lieutenant, Sack, and our company commander, Oscar Selgo, Lieutenant John Sack. He asked for 8 volunteers, and I'll never forget them. There was Warren Garrett. He was the old man of the outfit. He was 24, had 2 children. There was Trimble. There was me. There was Corporal Reed. He was in charge of the patrol. There was McCluskey. Never did find his body. There was Mitchell. He died of wounds. There was Jim White. And there was Lee Blanchard. Lee Blanchard stayed in the Marines and became a colonel. And we set out on February 28th to look for these spigot mortars and see where they were coming from. And then we had a radio with us. McCluskey was the radio man. And we strung the wire. And we went to a ridge between, there were two hills, 362 and 382. There was a ridge line. We went to the top, to the ridge line, and it overlooked an open mine sulfur pit. And when a shell would come and land in the sulfur pit, it would ignite the sulfur. It was a big open pit, and off to the right was the village of Moriyama, where the civilians had lived. And I don't know how they did it, but they raised pineapples on Iwo Jima and the volcanic ash is unbelievable. And we set up on the top. We set up around 6 o'clock in the evening. We set up two men on the top of the ridge with the radio. Then we dropped down 50 feet. So on top was Reed and McCluskey. Next came Netzel and Warren Garrett. Then came Trimble and me. And down at the bottom was Jim White and Lee Blanchard. Well, at midnight we were to shift every 6 hours. And there was always to be one man awake and one man asleep. Well, nobody ever did go to sleep. Because just before we were to switch, the Japanese started to infiltrate and come up the ridge. Now, years ago they made a movie Sherlock Holmes movie. It was called The Hound of Baskervilles, and I think they remade it with Robert Downey on some series, BBC. But the story was on the moors in Scotland, this fog would come up at night, and there was a huge hound that was in this fog, and he would come bounding out and kill people. Well, Sherlock Holmes was called in to solve the problem. Anyway, that's how I felt on Hill 362 and on the ridge in 382. I was waiting for this hound to come bounding out of the sulfur fumes. But what came out of the sulfur fumes were the Japanese who were coming at us. Now, mind you, there are 8 of us. And we, behind us, and we were in front of a mortar platoon. So we were right there in the front lines. And the Japanese had something that a few of us have seen on Iwo Jima. Not all outfits had it. They had on the back of their neck, they had a little pin, phosphorus pin. And with just a little moonlight or starlight, their officer could see his men and how they moved. We couldn't see the pin because it was on the back of their neck. But what happened was, at one point, a little bit after midnight, we turned around. And if you turned around and looked and you saw the pins, then we knew we were in big trouble. And the battle lasted about hand-to-hand combat about 3 hours. And thank God we had grenades the way we did. But what happened was, as I said, Reed, he was married. He had been stationed in Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. He was bayoneted. McCluskey, they never found his body. Netzel, he died of wounds received. Garrett, for some reason, the Japanese bayoneted him, and they took his rifle and left their rifle. Just something symbolic. Trimble and I did the best we could to hold them off. And as I said, the grenades came in handy. And there was no talking. There was just screaming and hollering and pointing out. And at one point, after a little after midnight, a little after 3 o'clock, Jimmy Trimble hollered, "Grenades." Now, the Japanese grenades didn't have a pin and a fly. Fly handle like we did. Their grenades, which were much smaller than ours and much weaker, some at the end of the war in Okinawa and parts of Iwo Jima were made out of, of course there was the iron, then there was the ones they made out of glass, and then they had them even made out of clay, like pottery, because they were running out of minerals. And anyway, what they would do is to ignite them, they would hit them together. And when you heard that click, you know grenades were coming. I didn't hear the click, but Trimble did, and he hollered, "Grenades." Before that, they got close enough to bayonet him in the shoulder. And coming at me was another Japanese soldier. He was crawling, and he had in his hand what I thought was a stick of dynamite or plastique. It was oblong and dark. And he was crawling towards me. Well, anyway, the Trimble's wound wasn't that bad, and he kept firing. And I shot and blew away the Japanese who got within a couple feet of me. And I just reached over and grabbed what he had in his hand, and it was a wooden box, and I stuck it in my pocket. Well, anyway, grenades came flying in right near the foxhole, and one came in the foxhole and it peppered Jimmy's back. It broke both of my legs and came very close to when I looked down, my crotch was just a bloody mess. And I pulled myself out of the hole. Trimble, he was still alive, and I reached in to help pull him out. And out of and at the same time, the Japanese had a looked like a baseball base. It was made out of canvas and was about the same size as a baseball base, maybe 15 inches square. And in each corner was a magnet, and it was loaded with explosive. And they would put that on a tank and try to blow the tank. Well, this soldier had this strapped to his body, and he climbed in the hole. Of course, I saw what he had on. I rolled away. He pulled the cord. The mine went, they called it Mine 90. Grenade 90, the Japanese did. And the Japanese just evaporated. And Trimble was, the whole, he was blown in half. The lower part of his body just separated completely. I was very fortunate. The two behind me, White and Blanchard, they came out of their hole. Blanchard picked me up, carried me back. White put on the tourniquets. He took my belt, took his belt, and he did something that he wasn't supposed to do. He took his bandages and did both my legs with my bandage and his bandages and put on sulfa drugs. And by this time it got to be about 4:30, and a corpsman came along and gave me a shot of morphine. And I can understand to this day how somebody becomes a heroin addict, because that morphine, even though I was banged up pretty good, that morphine just spreads a warm feeling over you, and you just completely relax, and the pain goes away. It's just marvelous. And they put a mark on your head, like they do for Catholics on, you know, on Wednesday, Ash Wednesday. So they put a mark on your head so they know that you had a morphine shot, and you don't get too many of them. Anyway, Corman gave me some plasma, and they carried me away down to a, what they would call on TV, a MASH unit, a medical unit, where they bandaged me up and try to set my legs, but it was just too much. And they shipped me. I was there 24 hours, and they shipped me down to the shore. They put me aboard. The hospital ships were all crowded, and they put me on a troop ship, put me in the kitchen, and that's where they operated on me and bound me up. And that's where I got a shot of penicillin. It turned out that I'm allergic to penicillin. I wear the medallion, and every time I go in the hospital, I put big signs all over, allergic to penicillin, because I went into a coma for 10 or 11 days, and your blood pressure drops down to nothing, and your skin just peels right off. And I woke up on Saipan in an army hospital in the tent. From there, they flew me to Johnson Island, where Amelia Earhart is supposed to be. And then from Johnson Island, they flew me to Hawaii. And by this time, it was April 1st. And that was, I remember that, it was Easter Sunday. And it also was the day that they invaded Okinawa. The hospital was so crowded in Hawaii that they put me in the VD ward. And because it was Sunday, everybody from that ward was mobile. They either went to the movies, went to eat, went for a walk. I was there alone. And they said that a congressman was coming through. Well, under normal conditions, the 17 or 18-year-old, I wouldn't have any idea who my congressman was. But I remember in newsreels, that Franklin Roosevelt, who was in a wheelchair, every time he came to address Congress, he would stop and talk to a congressman who was in a wheelchair, and that's how his name was Crosley, and that's how and that was my congressman, and that's how I knew when I saw the congressman that it was Congressman Crosley. And he came over and he said, how would you like to go? Asked me where I was, and I told him, you're my congressman, I'm from Cleveland, East Side. He said, how would you like to go home? I said, sure. He says, would you like to go today? I said, I sure would. Well, I didn't go that day. I went the next day. And I was on the first plane that flew from, that had Iwo casualties on it, and flew into Oakland Naval Hospital. From there I went to Sun Valley Rehab. From there I went to Great Lakes. From there I went to the Marine Hospital in Cleveland. There's no such thing as a Marine, U.S. Marine Hospital. This was a Merchant Marine Hospital. And I recuperated there, and life went on after that.
You had several more surgeries, from what I understand.
My last operation ended in 1982. And two women operated on me. And what saved me was, that's when the CAT scan came out. Before that, when they would operate for shrapnel, they would poke you, and then they would glue a paper clip to where they thought the shrapnel, but they didn't know how deep it was. And you know how a CAT scan works. It's one x-ray after another, and they can 3D it, and they can... They were able to spot what was really troubling me and take out the pieces that were embedded and weren't moving. And I haven't been back. I haven't had an operation since. They're little pieces of volcanic ash that come out, but it's just like a pimple. I can, with my fingernail, I can flick it out. And I did have braces. I got rid of them one by one. And I did get some gangrene infection that held me up for a while. And back in 1945 and 1946, you got to remember, therapy was bed rest. If they could get you in a whirlpool bath, and they would give you a back rub with Jergens lotion, that was it. There was no getting out of bed right after the operation. There was no moving after the cast came off. It was all bed rest. So it took me a little while to get organized.
Last question here in our last minute or so, maybe 2 minutes. Since that time, you've also been very active in honoring the memory of Jimmy Trimble, both at the American Veterans Center and elsewhere. Talk about how you took on that role and what it means to you.
Well, with the American Veterans Center, and with the St. Albans, where he went to prep school, we started a scholarship. And the last count that we had raised was $250,000. And it's for a Marine, but they'll take any son of a serviceman. Then we also instigated the Young Marine Award, every year an annual award that I donate to. And the American Veterans Center and I, they send the outstanding women young Marine and men young Marine. Now, this is not the real Marines. These are like the Boy Scout Marines.
Right.
And they're honored at the banquet, and at the American Veterans Center holds every year. And I just continue in tribute. I'm the head of the Military Order of the Purple Heart. I have the, in West Palm Beach, Florida, I have the second largest, I have 414 members. And The biggest award I ever got beside a Purple Heart was 2009. I received from the Pentagon the World War II Service and Community Service Award. Bob Feller got one. I got one. and a movie star, Hugh O'Brien, I got one too, and I'm here today, 89 years old, and feel like $1 million.
Well, you look great, and your story is incredible. Thank you. I know it's been a long day for you. Thank you very much for sharing your story again with us.
Okay.
Don Mates, veteran of World War II, Battle of Guam and Iwo Jima, U.S. Marine Corps veteran, 3rd Division. I'm Greg Corumbus. This has been Veterans Chronicles.
How cool was that? Yeah, Veterans Chronicles. And I've never heard anybody describe being in essentially a night attack, kind of like play by play, like he did, as vividly as he did. And the stories that he tells, you know, about still having shrapnel in him, and even when he'll talk about flicking sand, the coral sand that stayed in his body all those years, and then when he talks about what physical therapy was in 1945, all right, bed rest, you know, you got in a whirlpool, or they give you a back massage with Jergens lotion. Amazing, isn't it? Yeah. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed that. His observations, firsthand observations of being on Iwo Jima are pretty amazing. And I found that the other day and I thought, man, I need to share this. So there you have it. A little bit of bonus coverage here on a Wednesday hump day. So, no, I mean, where do we find those kind of people? You know, and then come home and do nothing but good things. So inspirational, absolutely positively inspirational. That'll do it on a Wednesday. If you're just tuning in, you're going to hear Alex Holling. But before that, in the first hour, you're going to hear me talk about the incredible nature of our democracy, how resilient it is. You know, how resilient the American democracy is, because we have politicians that are an absolute embarrassment to the nation, that don't have any desire to do the work of the people, that they go and they play political reindeer games. Well, you know, Americans deal with issues that they can't... that they need help with. And I don't care if we talk health care, I don't care if we talk the border, the major issues that confront the nation, they're supposed to get solved by the people we elect. And instead we watch this endless parade of bullshit on TV. And now what makes it worse is we have a media that's not interested in the truth anymore. All it is clickbait that drives revenue, blah, 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 blah. So... I wax eloquent about that. And two stories. The ongoing story of the human tragedy that takes place on our border on a daily basis. And also, just in my opinion, the absolute farce that is going on in Sacramento, California. We have politicians that are afraid. They're afraid of people screaming hysterically. And a newspaper amplifying the scream, and they won't stand up and tell the truth. In spite of the fact that a district attorney and the attorney general of California, who's incredibly liberal, have both said there's no reason to prosecute two police officers. And it's you watch it, it's sickening. So, anyway, you'll hear that. And then Alex Hollings joins us, and normally we talk about a bunch of the stuff he's written, and today we kind of get into a discussion about health and mental health. So you'll find it interesting. Alex always an interesting interview, and so you'll hear his thoughts. So that's interesting. And then a little bonus coverage. Alex, we kept a little longer than normal. And then a little bonus coverage that just concluded, and that is Don Mates. And Don is a former Marine, participated in combat operations on Guam and Iwo Jima, was part of the PSD of General Erskine, and was wounded during that. So, anyhow, you'll enjoy that if you didn't just hear it. So, have a great day on a Wednesday. All Marine Radio. Over and out.